Okay, just the way you tell me. Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Heil, and I'm an alcoholic. Since April 12th of 1990, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol or other mood-altering substance to live in this great world, and that's been a good deal for me. And really, the purpose I'm here for tonight, I'm kind of like the closing act. I mean, what can you say after you got Debbie Does Dallas and God's team ahead of you, you know? I don't know if I can do very much to follow that up, but I'll give it a try. I am really grateful to be here tonight. I wanted to ask one question right off the bat. I mean, who is taking care of Texas this week? Does George know you're all gone? No, it's really good to be here at the Texas State Convention. Oh, yeah. I say that with a lot of love in my heart. I, a couple years ago, had an opportunity to go down to the Man-to-Man Conference down in Lake Brownwood, Texas, and met a number of guys that are here tonight, and they've really been supportive since I've been back. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing. I didn't know a lot of their names, but, you know, as soon as I saw their faces, I remembered that incredible, wonderful experience that we had. And so it's really good to be here. And I want to thank all of the people on the committee, and there's tons of them. And just like last night when Mary Ann said, I'm not going to try to name anybody in particular because they've all been just so wonderful. I've never quite been to a conference this comprehensive. I don't know about you all, but this is something special. You know, when those kids came out, that really touched my heart. I thought of my own kids. I thought of my little grandbaby. And that these kids have had 10 years exposure to something like this is kind of an amazing deal to me, you know, because I was 40 years old before I even had a clue about what this whole thing was about. And so kudos to those people who do that year in and year out. I have a hard time getting used to sometimes that, you know, I'm in Crested Butte, Colorado. You know, how did I get to Crested Butte, Colorado? A kid from Kentucky. And, you know, I've been a lot of places the last couple of years as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been to California, Texas, Michigan, a lot of places, and it's been a wonderful thing. You know, because I grew up in a little bitty world. You know, I came from an Irish Catholic family in Kentucky. And my daddy told me one time, I remember I was about 12 years old, he said, Tim, there's only three things you need to know about life. Here they are. Basketball, you pull for Kentucky. Football, you pull for Notre Dame. And you vote the straight Democratic ticket. You know, that's it. Now go out and live, you know. And I say that because, you know, by the time I got here April 12th of 1990, my world had gotten so small that it was down to me. You know, I started out with a pretty small world and managed to, over the next 40 years, to make it incredibly small. You know, I always share this story. When I was in AA for about probably 6 to 8 months, and they told me to get a lot of guys' numbers and work with a lot of guys, and I did. I would go to meetings. I had a lot of guys I was working with, and they'd call me. And I have a business, I have an insurance office, and I'd go out and make my sales calls. And so one particular day I called in to get my calls, and this little girl answered, and I said, Tammy, give me my calls. She said, all right, Tim, here they are. She said, Joe called, and he said, thanks for last night. Jim called and said, could he get together with you tonight? Steve called and said, could he have lunch with you tomorrow? And she said, and then there's one more. I said, well, go ahead. She said, and, well, Jerry called Tim. He said he loves you. I said, Tammy, look, when we get in there, I need to have a talk with you. And as it turned out, I shared my story for the first time with somebody outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as it turned out, that little girl had a daddy who was an alcoholic and had a husband who was on his way. And so that's kind of the way it's worked for me. And God's brought people into my life one by one that way. My daddy was one of those Irish Catholics. I know there's a few of those guys in here today. And he liked to sing and get drunk, or get drunk and sing. You know, and he's one of these guys, he only knew the first verse to any song, every song. And there was this one little song he used to sing, and I'm not going to sing it, so don't get alarmed. But the verse of the song went like this. When God made the Irish, he didn't make them much, but he made them a hell of a lot better than the goddamn Dutch. What you got to see is seven little kids sitting around in the afternoon where daddy come home from the tavern singing that song, you know. I remember one time my brother Danny had to take a poem into grade school, and that's what he took in. The nuns did not see the humor in that little round. You know. But, you know, I think that little thing stuck with me. You know, when God made me, he didn't make me much, but he made me better than you. You know, got the Alcoholics Anonymous, heard you all talking about egomaniac with inferiority complex. Egomaniac with inferiority complex. I wouldn't much, but I was better than you. You know, if you have an inside like that, and I did, and you go out and try to live life, life is tough, you know. Jobs were impossible. Relationships were very difficult. Because if you were really not much, but you really got to pretend that you're better than everybody else, you know, life can be kind of rocky. And I see that today. Obviously, I never saw it the whole time it was going on. I like to talk right off the bat about a couple things that are really important to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I came to the rooms, like you're all sitting there tonight, they told me to sit down, take a seat, and listen, and I did. And they said, you know, but when I would come to meetings, what I would do, I would listen to what you all did and what you didn't do. So I'd be out there sitting, the guy would be up here talking, or the lady would be up here talking. So I'd be listening, I would go, well, I did that, I did that, I did that. Hell, I didn't do that, I did not do that. Next night, next speaker, you know, did it, didn't do it. You know, next night, did it, didn't do it. You know, the didn'ts were big. Now, if I get enough didn'ts, I'm out of here, you know. I was at a lady, of all things, I was at a meeting about 6 weeks into this, and she was talking, I was listening. I said, well, I did that, I did that, I did that, oh, hell, I did that, too. And right at the end of her talk, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, well, I did not do that. Called my sponsor that night. He said, well, it sounds like getting a little bit desperate to me, Tim. You know, and the reason I say that, you know, because when I got here, you know, I didn't know what an alcoholic looked like. And they suggested, well, Tim, it looks a lot like you. You know, I didn't want to hear that. I don't know what I thought I was going to see. I think we all have our ideas, but I thought a lot of dirty old men in raincoats, you know, that type of thing. Didn't see that. You know, I saw a little bit of this. I saw people dressed well, having a lot of fun, you know, men, women, you know, real confusing. I couldn't tell you were drunk by looking at you, not in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I sit around the rooms and I listen to everybody share, you know, and as I did that, you know, I noticed one thing. I heard people talking about three things, three distinctive things. They were talking about being irritable, restless, and discontented. They were talking about being apart from, not a part of. And they were talking about continuing patterns of progressive dishonesty in their lives. Whew. You know, when I heard those things, you know, what was undeniable to me is that those three things have always been part of my deal. At always, from the get-go, restless, irritable, discontent. What is that? I don't know. I just got it. You know? Wake up with it. Most powerful thing I ever hear anybody in AA say, you know, you walk up to somebody and say, hey, Butch, how's it going? And he says, ah, oh, God, I don't know, Tim. Just kind of feel, you know? I go, yeah, I know. I know, man. You know, we're talking today in a meeting about the hole, filling up the hole. What is that? I don't know what it is. I know I've got it, and I know when I was 15 years old, and I put a drink of alcohol on it, it took it away. Never forgot that, chased that for about the next 30 years, you know. And the significance of that was, they said, guess what? When you stop drinking, you're going to have that irritable, restless, discontented nature to deal with. And we're going to teach you 12 steps and put you in a fellowship that's designed to give you something else to do besides drink when you have that feeling. And thank God that happened, because, you know, I don't know about you, but as hard as I've tried over the last 10 years, you know, I still wake up someday with that hole in my soul, with that thing in my gut. Don't know where it came from, you know. You know, I with restless, irritable, and discontent, I think back, crazy stuff goes through my mind. You remember the show, The Incredible Hulk? Really, that's my whole story. You know, think about this. There was this guy, Dr. David Banner. He was clean cut, kind of a mild-mannered guy. He didn't want to cause anybody any trouble. He just wanted to go about his own business. But every week, some person, place, or thing would get in this guy's way. And you talk about irritable, restless, and discontent. You know? He blows up into this green thing and he tears up everything and destroys everybody around him. You know, when he comes out of it, you know, and I always used to hurt for him. He would come out of it and look around Everything was all tore up. He packed his bags. You know, he'd do the same damn thing next week. And that's kind of really what my story was, you know. Apart from, not a part of, you know, what's that all about? You know, I don't know either. I heard a lot of people talking about this week. You know, when I come to big groups, this part of my alcoholism really shows up. And Marianne was talking about it last night, and she hit me right in the soul with it. You know, she said, you know, it's great, I love it, I'm going home. It's great, I love it, I hate it, these people are crazy. You know, and here I am 10 years sober. You know, I come to a place like this, it is absolutely gorgeous. I know a lot of people here, I love you all. And a couple times the last couple days, that thing shows up and says, you don't belong here. You're from Kentucky, for Christ's sake. See, these Texans don't want you here. You're only 10 years sober. You know, crazy. What's that all about? Well, I really think that's about my alcoholism. Because all my life, there's been something about me that's wanted to separate me from you. You know, and I really want to say this, because probably the most important thing was ever told to me by guys like Jack Sullivan and the guys ahead of me in Louisville, is that, you know, stay in the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to feel bad, you're going to feel sad, you're going to feel happy, you're going to feel glad. Stay in the loop. Show up. Stay around us. Because there's going to come a time where this part of you is going to start telling you it's time to go. Let me tell you, when I was about 5 years sober, and I was right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville. I mean, man, I'm Mr. Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I'm going to a meeting every day. I got a meeting in my house, a meeting in my office, sponsored 22 guys. You know, I am ripping it. And I'm dying, you know. I am absolutely crazy. And if you were around me back then, you'd hear me saying things like, well, you know, that sponsor I've had for 5 years, he was doing all right for a while. He's really getting crazy here lately. And that home group of mine, they're doing the dumbest things. And for God's sake, the people they're letting in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, the caliber is way down. You know, now that's what you're hearing me saying. What was really going on is I was slowly starting to back out the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've always been fascinated in the book by what they talk about, the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink. What is that? I don't know what that is either, but the interesting part about it is I can always see it in you, but I can never see it in me. I can always see it in you, but I can never see it in me. You know, and 5 years ago, thank God, there was guys like Jack Sullivan and guys that had come to know me over 5 years, and they heard me saying those crazy things. And they stayed around me, and they said, keep coming back. And they kept me in the loop, and I came through that nuttiness. And I didn't walk away. You know, I didn't show up one day and somebody said, what happened to good old Tim? You know, he was a good guy. Where'd he go? I didn't just one day slowly separate. So this staying a part of has just become such an essential part of my program today. The third thing I heard you all talking about were progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. Well, when I heard that one, you know, it really hit me in the gut because, you know, I was the type of guy that looked back. I lied if the truth was good enough, you know. I was a pretty good athlete, you know, so if I scored 20 points in a game and I came home, you'd say, how many did you score? I'd say, 24, you know. Got a B on the test, come home, what'd you get? B+. Of course, the problem with a lie is that you tell the one and you got to back it up with the second one. So the paper would come out the next day and would have 20 points, and they'd say, I thought you said you scored. I said, nope, the paper's wrong, you know. Teacher's wrong, you know. And, you know, I would think, why am I doing that? You know, the truth is good enough here. Why do you do that? And again, you know, that was a progressive thing in my life because, you know, as I went forward, I found myself, you know, as my drinking increased, it's something that we have to do. You know, it's something that we have to do if you drank the way I drank. You know, that I was 2 or 3 years sober, I don't know how long, and I was back at home with my wife at that time. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, my 13-year-old daughter says to me, hey, Dad, can I order a pizza? I said, oh, honey, no, you better not. Your mother will go crazy. She said, oh, come on, let me. I said, all right, go ahead. So she orders the pizza. 1:15 in the morning, doorbell rings, you know. Here comes my wife out of the bedroom screaming at my daughter saying, what in the hell are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning? My daughter said, well, Dad said I could. My wife said, did you say she could? I said, no. My daughter said, Dad, you're lying. I said, I know what I do it all the time. Called my sponsor. He said, "What's wrong?" I said, "I'm 2 years sober, and I just lied about a pepperoni pizza." Now, I say all that to say this. You know, restless, irritable discontent, apart from, not a part of, and progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. Those are the things that I wrestle with today. Those are the things that can kick my butt on any given day. I have got to find a way to deal with this, whatever it is within me. Because as much as I was off on my way to sainthood, it still shows up. That shadow side of me, that alcoholic side of me, still is there. The difference today is they gave me a way. They gave me 12 steps. They gave me people to talk to that I can deal with that without taking a drink of alcohol. Stay in part of this group. Stay in part of a close group of support people at home has become absolutely essential for me. And in trying to learn to tell the truth and live an honest life the best I can is what the whole deal is about for me today. So those are the things, you know, that I've found common amongst us all. You know, no matter what your story is, if you pay close attention, you know, those are the three things we have to wrestle with. You know, I had a lot of skills and talents. You know, I was the oldest of seven kids, grew up in an Irish Catholic family. In my family, it wasn't if you were going to drink, it was when and how good were you going to do it, you know. I grew up as a kid listening to a lot of stories, you know, my daddy and uncles. They'd sit around and tell stories like, well, you remember old Uncle Pat, he had that one leg there, and he used to sit in that rocker with his shotgun, get half loaded. And remember that night old Uncle Tom, he was coming in the window because Aunt Aggie locked the door, and Uncle Pat shot him, you know, and everybody'd laugh and have another drink. Or how about the time my grandpa, you know, he got beat up at an Honest Abe's Tavern, came home, got a shotgun. He's going to go back and get that guy. But Uncle Willie tackled him in the street, and everybody'd laugh and have another drink. You know, I used to think, well, hell, that's not funny. You know, I heard a guy in California say there was two types of people in his family, and this is the way my family was. Until me, I think I was the first alcoholic. Up until that time, there were two types of people. You were either a character or you were a nervous person. Like, no, seriously, you know, Uncle Tom shot Uncle Pat. He's a character. I said, no, Dad, he's a killer, you know. And then we had one guy, Uncle George, he had this green medicine that he drank all the time. You know, so up until I got sober, you know, we had characters and nervous people. I was the first alcoholic. And I say that to you because I'm trying to talk to you about the environment I grew up in. Drinking, obviously, was a part of it, and as much as you can and whenever you could. And obviously it was supposed to be a good time, but the truth of it was, there was always that, you know, it always started out great. You know, it was always a lot of fun. And it always ended up in a fight. And it always ended up somebody getting hurt and going home. So I came along with that, and I don't know when I had my first drink, you know, in all honesty. You know, we sipped at it, you know, the old Mogan David wine and beer, you know, almost from the beginning. I remember my first blackout, or had to be my first blackout, when I was about 16 years old, and a group of older guys said, hey, we're going to go out and play some basketball. Would you like to go with us? And I said, yeah. And we went out. And after that, they opened their trunk and had a bunch of beer in the trunks, and we drank that beer. And that was the first night that I started out one place and ended up someplace else 5 hours later without any idea how I got there. And that would be the first of many occasions where that phenomena that we know now called a blackout occurred. I, as I said, was the oldest of those seven kids, and I had some skills, I had some talents. In fact, I went to a Division I college on a basketball scholarship, and that was really a big deal in my family. And one, because nobody had ever gone to college, and two, when I was about 12 years old, my daddy was involved in a big white-collar crime in Louisville. And it was one of those things we probably wouldn't even make the front page today. In the environment we live in, but then it was a big deal. And it was one of those things where it was real embarrassing. It was probably the first time I got a real handle on what shame's all about. And it was one of those things where we'd have to go to school every day and fight with the kids over them making fun of our daddy and that type of thing. And he went into prison and came out right when I was getting ready to go to high school. And the significance of that was that, you know, what probably happened, and I really couldn't help it, was that I kind of picked up on this deal. Well, you know, I'll make up on the sports page what Dad tore down on the front page. Now, I didn't set out to do that deliberately. I think that's just kind of what happened. And so not only did I get into that, but my whole family really did. And so this basketball thing and my prowess in that became really a big deal. And I was pretty good at it. I was an all-state player, and I got my name in the paper a lot, my picture in the paper a lot. And I'm really saying this because I want to tell you it was my whole self-esteem. You know, it's who I was. It's the only thing I really could do that was me. Because I had the insides that we talk about all the time that had to be protected by my outsides. And that was a job that wore me out almost on a daily basis. I don't know about you guys. But anyway, I went to this Division I college on this basketball scholarship. And alcohol worked so quickly in my life that by the first game of my sophomore year, I showed up at the first game so drunk that the other players hit me on the end of the bench so the coach wouldn't catch me and throw me out of school. You know, now I'm talking, we were played in the league with teams like Cincinnati and Louisville and Kentucky and some really good teams. So you got to imagine there's a drunk kid sitting on the end of the bench. And I looked back on that one time and thought, wow, you know, how did I do that? Or why would I do that? You know, and it really was pretty simple. It was a combination of two things. The first thing was, I ran into a guy and said, do you want to go get a drink? And I said, well, yeah. I never said no. I can't ever remember in my whole life. I don't care what the circumstances were of saying no. So we went and had a drink. The second thing was, and this is kind of pertinent to the rest of my story, is that, you know, I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get in the game. You know, I was a sophomore. I'd worked real hard, but the coach the day before had said, these are the players who are going to start, and these are the guys who are going to get in the game. And I wasn't one of them. You know, I had this thing in my whole story, my whole, as I did my four-step, that all in my life, I come to these points in my life where I start to realize that I'm not getting the respect that a man of my stature should be getting. You know? It always happens. It happens in relationships. It's happened on my jobs. It happened on this team. And that was the other part of this. I wasn't getting the respect that a player of my, you know, stature should have been getting. So I got drunk, you know. Perfectly logical approach to problem solving. The interesting thing happens, I get to the game and they had me on the end of the bench because I'm not going to get in. I'm the second substitute the guy puts in the game. You know, I'm out there, I see three basketballs, two baskets, you know. I was in the game 2 minutes. I got two shots at the basket and I swished them both, you know. So, I mean, the deal with this is not only do I not get caught, you know, I'm kind of like the hero because now I'm the drunk who made two baskets, you know. Unfortunately, it was kind of like the highlight of my college career. You know, it's kind of downhill from there. I went through that college and I got through it. You know, I became a daily drinker. You know, what I'm trying to say to you, I'm 19 years old and alcohol has jumped to the top spot. You know, basketball was the last holdout. It was the thing I held above everything else. But by the time I'm 19, it became more important for me on a daily basis to find a way to drink. Also, about the time, you know, I started to compromise the values that my parents had given me to, and they had given me good values. You know, so I started to steal or take tests for people, hock everything that I owned to get money to drink that day. You know, my nickname at that college was the Vagabond. You know, there's a wonderful name for a college kid, you know. And I got that name because I just kind of appeared anywhere and everywhere. You know, I might be at your place one night, your place the next night, under a tree. You know, I mean, it's just the way it was. You know, it just became a way of living for me. I, amazingly enough, was going to graduate from that school. My grades weren't very good. But it was 1970. Now, if you, those of you can do a little history here. 1970, you can only do two things. You go to work or you go to war. You know, and I wasn't too interested in either one, you know. I kind of wanted to keep the party going if I could. You know, and I thought, well, Tim, you know, you've got some brains. And I'm saying this because this is the first time in my memory of my adult life I thought, well, I'm going to take over here. I'm going to make some plans for my future. I said, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you take the law test, pass that law test, get into law school, graduate from law school, and run for Congress and then go on for President of the United States. I thought, hell, if you're going to have a plan, you know, have a plan. So I took the test to get into law school, you know, and my score was so bad that I got turned down by the law school, you know. And now, I mean, I am really desperate. You know, as meager as it was, my whole life is in the balance here because it's Vietnam or Vietnam or Vietnam. So I said, Tim, why don't you come up with a new plan? And here was a new plan, all right? For the next 5 weeks, I'm not going to drink. And I'm going to get somebody to help me study for this test. I'm going to get a tutor. I'm going to study every day. I'm going to go take that test again. I'm going to pass that test, get into law school, graduate from law school, Congress, President of the United States. For the next 5 weeks, for the first time in 5 years, I did not drink a drop. And I did not like that because it was at the end of the senior year and everybody was having fun, having a good time. But hey, man, my life was on the line. Came down to the day before the test. I made a slight change to my plan. Now, here was a new plan. I'm going to go out, have a couple of beers so I can relax, come back, get up, take that test, pass that test, get into law school, graduate from law school, Congress, President of the United States. Same plan, one slight change. You know, that was a Friday afternoon. I didn't even get back to that campus to the following Tuesday. You know, I ended up riding around St. Louis on a city bus about a day and a half, blacked out on that bus. You know, I got here and you all were talking about physical allergy and mental obsession. I said, what is that? He said, well, it's kind of like this, Tim. You got a body that always wants to drink and a mind that never wants to stop. And I had no conception at that time that I never could drink two beers. Never did then, never did my whole life. You know, the interesting thing about that story, about 1 o'clock that Friday night, I was still lucid enough to realize I wasn't going to take the test. So I went back to the dorm, I found a guy, I paid him $20 to go take that law test. And I went out and got drunk for 3 days. Found a smart guy, too. And he went and took that test. About 6 weeks later, we got the results of that law board that he took for me. The damn guy got the highest score in the history of the law school. I think like 800 was perfect. You know, he got like a 790. I had gotten a 390 on the one I took. Slight discrepancy in the scores. You know, and I say this because this was one of the first times that I really got a feel of the shame that goes along with alcoholism. Because, you know, I figured, boy, I better get to the dean before they get to me. And I went to the dean's office, made an appointment to see him, and I'll never forget this because, you know, he sat there at his desk and I walked in. And here I am, 23 years old, in a major law school, lying through my teeth to this guy. And he never said a word. He just stood there and listened to me. And I said, well, Dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in them two schools. And he never said a word. He just looked at me. I said, well, see what happened? I decided at the last minute I didn't want to be a lawyer, and I let this other guy take the test. How did he do? And he never said a word to me. And here's what I wanted to share. You know, I remember turning in that office that night, and I'm 23 years old, and for one brief moment, what went through my mind was, Tim, you know what the deal is, man. It's the booze. The booze took the basketball, and the booze took your right to go to law school because you have the ability and you know it. I'll tell you how long that lasted. I walked out that door, ran into two guys I know. They said, hey, let's go get a drink. I said, yeah, let's do it. And I was off and running, you know, for another 25 years. But I don't know why that stuck in my mind. I don't know why that happened that day. And I often thought, hey, how come I didn't figure this out a long time ago? And what I was told here by you people is it doesn't happen that way. You know, it happens for you if it happens, when it happens. So I came back to Louisville. You know, I'd gone there in all my glory and came home in all my shame. You know, and until my mom passed away in 95, she was the only living soul until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous who knew that story. Because obviously I just told everybody else I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I just came on back to Louisville to... so I could teach and coach. And I came back to Louisville to get into teaching and coaching. Teaching and coaching is a tough place to hide out when you're a young alcoholic. You know, you got to show up every morning and face, you know, I was teaching at the high school level and face 35, you know, teenage boys every morning. You know, the first school I was at, I was the dean of students. That meant you had to check into me every morning, you know, if you were late or whatever the case was. And this was during the 70s, and I always like to share this story, and I'll tell you why. And I was sitting there one morning, boy, just hung over real bad. You know, I had a big old tomato head. And I was sitting there just hanging on for dear life. And, you know, this was in the 70s when the kids were out there in the parking lot hitting a few doobies, you know, to get ready for class. And I looked up one day, and here's this kid standing up over me. He had his army jacket on, had that long hair all dangling down there, eyes all smoked up. And he kind of looked down at me and said, hey, Mr. Highland, you're looking bad, dude. I said to him, hey, by God, I'm in charge here. You know, I tell you why I share that story. That particular kid is 16 years sober today in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to go down to Destin, Florida a couple years ago and visit with him, and it was really a neat deal. We went to some meetings together, but when I got off the airplane, he said, hey, coach, he always called me coach. He said, look, I ain't never told my kids now how I was now. If you don't tell them, I won't say anything about you. I said, you got to do that. You know, and I did that for 10 years in Louisville, a teaching and coaching thing, and out in the south end of Louisville, kind of where Jack was from out there. And, you know, I very rarely go into a meeting in Louisville, in that end of town, where I don't run into one of those kids. You know, and it's kind of a neat deal because they see me and it's like, uh-huh, we knew you'd be here. I go like, I knew you'd be here too, you little shit, you know. Oh, man. Oh, boy. You know, this would be a good point for me to say this. I mean, I love to laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I want to tell you, when I got here, there was not anything funny about anything. And I said this in a meeting earlier, and I don't know if he's here or, Ken D, who's going to speak here Friday night. Somebody started giving me his tapes, and I started listening to him. And his story was so much like mine, and I heard him laughing at himself and laughing at his family. And I started to laugh, you know. And so thank God and thank you to all of you people who have taking the time to tell your stories, it's sometimes embarrassing as they are, so that we can laugh when we're in early sobriety. It's so important. But, you know, let me diverse a little bit and tell you a story about one of those kids that I taught, because I think it's such an essential story to my sobriety today. But 4 or 5 years ago, I guess, probably 6 years ago now, this kid came into the program. Not only had I taught and coached this kid in high school, I had known him since he was a little bitty guy. His family had 7 kids, just like ours did. He grew up on the next street over. And he showed up in AA one day, and I got to be a sponsor. And, you know, for a couple of years, we had a real good ride. You know, we were going to the same meetings and just, you know, great sponsor-sponsee relationship. You know, then all of a sudden, I didn't hear from him very much, you know. Once in a while, he would call me. I'd say, Chris, what's going on? You're not going to meetings? He said, no, Tim, you know, I got involved in the Big Brothers program. And it kind of does for me what AA does. You know, I work with these little kids in the ghetto, and it really does something for me. And I said, Chris, you know, I'll tell you this, because this is what the people ahead of told me. I said, you know, I'm an alcoholic, you know, and I have got to stay around my own kind. I'm not saying what you're doing is not good, but I've got to stay around my own kind. Well, you know, time went on. What happened to this guy is that his life took a turn. And what happened, he had a baby by a woman. And for 1 year, he raised this baby all by himself. And then that woman came back and just out of meanness and spite and took this baby away from him and would not let him see that baby. You know, and he went into an obsession of the mind that I think the book talks about, you know. Because I want to tell you, no matter what we told him, you know, he was never going to see that baby. And you could see the spiral of alcoholism. You could see the depression. You could see the denial. He called me about 3 years ago, I guess, 2 days before St. Patrick's Day. 1 o'clock in the morning. Said, Tim, you know, I can't do this anymore. You know, I got to do something, you know. Depression's killing me. I said, Chris, I'll tell you what we need to do. We need to do the first 3 steps on our knees again tomorrow. You know, there's only one person. There's only one way it can help you with this problem, and that's God. And I hung up, and we were going to get together the next morning and do that. But, you know, it never happened. Because later that night, another guy I sponsored called me, and he said, you know, Tim, I'm at Chris's house, and he's dead. And I went over that night, and I'm going to tell you what I saw. I saw this 6'2", good-looking blonde kid sitting out in his garage next to his car, empty fifth of Jack Daniels underneath that seat, the hose laying in his lap that had come out of his exhaust. And what went through my mind, and I want to share this with you, was, you know, I don't care if I become the deacon of 147 churches, the head of the Boy Scouts of America. You know, I don't care if the world lets me do all the wonderful good things that I can do. If I forget first and foremost what I am and where I belong, you can forget about the rest. You know? I mean, the Big Brothers was a great thing. You know, I worked in hospice. It's a wonderful thing. But if I forget that I'm an alcoholic, and first and foremost, that I belong right here, it's simply not going to work. You know, and the reason I say that is, you know, I run into people that I came in the program with today. I say, hey, I don't see you around much. They go, oh, well, you know, Tim, coaching Little League, you know, working in the church. And I think, boy, I hope that works for you. I really hope that works for you. You know, I like to share Chris's story because, you know, he was the only alcoholic in his family. And his mom and dad said, Tim, we don't understand. And it hurt me so much because I could tell, no, they didn't understand. They didn't understand how any problem in the world could force somebody to pick up a fifth of liquor that would take his life. But I understood. Because I had been so close to that point so many times. And his grace had got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And why he didn't pick up the phone again that night and call me, I don't know. But I hope that his story will be there for me to remember when that time comes for me. Because I'm convinced it will. I'm convinced life will present me sooner or later with those types of opportunities. You know, also in the 70s, you know, I got married to my high school sweetheart. And that's a whole story in itself. And it's actually changed a little bit. And just to give you a little capsule of that, we got married in 1970. We got divorced for the first time in 1983. Got back together in 1986. Got divorced again in 1989. Got back together and then got divorced again in 1994. You know, you tell people at your work that, they go, what? You tell people in AA, they go, oh, hell, sounds normal to us. Oh, boy. Now, what's that all about? You know, I think you know what that's all about. That's all about alcoholism and everything that goes with it, you know. I was real slow coming to understand how people around us are affected, you know, real slow. I really want to thank Jack and Nancy today for the workshop on emotional and physical intimacy and relationships, you know. Because I'm 52 years old, and I can sit here and tell you now with all honesty, I had no clue how to do this my whole life, you know. And since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been married one time again. Lasted 7 months, you know, to a real good AA lady, supposedly. And that was really... supposedly. Can we back the tape up there? No, she's a very good AA lady. Absolutely. I guess the point I wanted to make is that, you know, I've had, and it's kind of what Miriam was talking last night, you know, 10 years into sobriety, you know, and I've worked a good program or as hard as I can work it. The fact that I've been unable to have legitimate, successful relationships is not something I feel really good about. But I want to share this with you. And this would be a good time to do it. You know, I told you about being at the Man to Man conference. That was May a couple years ago, and I'd just gone through this breakup of the relationship I had in the program. And I was in May, and I got back in June of that year. I got back in May, got back to Louisville. In June of that year, got a call from the first wife, second wife, third wife. And she asked me if I'd like to go on vacation with the kids, because we had three beautiful children. And I said, sure, I'd love to. And we went, you know, and slept in separate rooms and started a relationship after 30 years, you know, that we've never had before. You know, I tell everybody it's our 30th anniversary will be coming up this November. You know, so that's our gross anniversary. Net somewhere in between 24 and 25, I think. Oh, boy. But, you know, let me tell you what happened down there. You know, I left the man-to-man conference, you know, and I shared my story. And after that meeting, two of these old Texans came up to me, and I said, yeah. He said, you know what, boy? He said, I've married the same woman four different times. He said, you know what? If she'd have me, I'd marry her again. You know, AA is the greatest place in the world. We have, and I wanted to say this, because I don't know really how to share this, That lady is not legally my wife right now, but probably is more my wife and my spouse and my partner than we've ever been in our life. We absolutely, at this moment, are better parents, better grandparents, better friends, better lovers. You know, this is a program of the second chance and the third chance. You know, where else in the world? And a fourth chance. You know, and I listened to the people share today in the workshop, you know, and I thought, you know, I'm not so different. You know, it's not something that we all don't struggle with. You know, I heard a guy say one time that, you know, this is a Catholic priest that I listened to, and he's not an alcoholic at all, but he said, you know, he works with a lot of alcoholics, and he said, you know, all alcoholics are wounded lovers. And what he meant by that was somewhere back in our life, it might have been in the womb, we knew what home was. We knew what the warmth of being where we're supposed to be. And then we lost it. And then we got into this search the rest of our life trying to find it. And most of us went to alcohol or to drugs to try to get back home. Wounded lovers. And, you know, and I say that because, you know, I can honestly say, 10 years through this program, I've been, a wounded lover. And gently and slowly, but surely, you know, I'm starting to heal. I'm starting to learn from you people how to love and how to receive love. That's what it's all about. Now, I wish it could have happened quicker for me, but it just hasn't. But I want to tell you, this is the first time this special friend of mine, I'd like her to stand up now, has ever been in an AA conference where I've spoken. And it's one of, this is my love of my life, Gail. Also, that's the first time I've had a ride through that story, so bear with me. Also during the 70s, you know, how about if you want something very special as a father, how about having your oldest son born on Christmas morning? You know, in 1971, that's what happened to me. And I was supposed to be in the delivery room with her and be there for that delivery, and I wasn't there. I was in the hospital, and I was in the men's room with my head in the toilet bowl spitting up whiskey. You know, that's the best I could do that Christmas morning. You know, and that's the best I could do for that kid that morning. I could not be there for that kid, my oldest son. And I really couldn't be there for him for the next 16 years because by the time I got sober, you know, he was off to college. And we had a little confrontation right before he left over something he was involved in. And he told me very clearly, he said, "Dad, I want to tell you one thing. I hate you. I hate you because all you think about is you." He said, "Even since you stopped drinking, all you think about is you." Ooh. You know, I was about 6 months sober. You know, and that just hit me in the gut. You know, I remember going to these meetings and talking to guys like Jack and these old-timers. And I'm saying, you know, I'm sober 6 months and this kid tells me this. And they said, "Hey, listen, let me tell you something. You will earn credibility in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. For God's sakes, you drank for 25 years. You think you're going to get credible in 6 months?" You know, I say that because that's exactly the way it's worked. You know, it was about 6 years into my sobriety, and that was not a good relationship, you know. But one night, he called me from Seattle, and he was having some pain, and he was having some trouble. And he said, "Dad, I need your help. And can I come home, and can I talk with you, and can I stay with you for a while?" You know, it's a thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 years into the deal. And that relationship with that oldest son, that Christmas baby, has gotten better each day that I don't drink and do the next right thing. You know, the 70s, I got out of teaching and coaching in the 70s because I started to notice that I wasn't getting the type of respect that a guy my stature should be getting. And I got into my own business in the 1980s. Now, let me give you a little capsule of the 1980s so we can speed this up. The 1980s, we've already mentioned, I got divorced from Gail the first time in 83, back together in 86, divorced again in 89, back together in 90. I was engaged to two other women in between those times. I was in the nut house twice. I lived 17 different places. I had 14 different business partners. I got stabbed with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. You know, kind of your basic alcoholic decade. You know? And I always say it that way, you know, because when I got here, I had no doubt that alcohol kicked my butt. But I still had a question as to whether my life was unmanageable. Nobody else did, just me. You know, and, you know, after we busted up, you know, in the early 80s, you know, I was living with my mom and dad, you know, back at home. I'd started my own business. You know, I used to run the guys I went to high school with. They'd say, "Hey, Tim, how you doing?" I'd say, "Oh, great. What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm president of my own company." They'd say, "No kidding. Where are you living?" I'd say, "Oh, with mom and dad." And it wasn't like, I wasn't starting to seek the solution then, you know, because by this time I'm going to psychiatrists and psychologists. We've done the marriage counselors. I went to 5 different psychiatrists from 82 to 85, you know. And it was a pretty simple deal, you know. I stuck with them until they started talking about alcohol. I got rid of that one, got the next guy. You know, I was living with my mom and dad and had one of those days, you know, which we have, where, you know, I just couldn't live drunk, couldn't live sober. Depression had gotten to be enormous. You know, I was taking, you know, antidepressants. They don't work well when you drink whiskey and beer with them. It brought me to, somebody identified back there, yeah. You know, New Year's Eve, 1985, you know, it was one of those days. And called Gail, my ex-wife at the time, and asked her for help, and they tried to find me a doctor. Turned out that night my brother Tommy took me to the nut house, our local nut house, Our Lady of Peace, and they drugged me in there that night, and you know, and I was a mess, you know, full of booze from all week and just suicidal. I just wanted to die. And this is how I remember it. You know, they put me in the back of this hospital into this room with these two nurses. There was an old nurse and a young nurse. And I sit down in the chair and this old nurse said, "Well, honey, tell me about it." I said, "All right, I will." And I started telling her, well, you know, in 83, my first wife left me. And then I got engaged to this other woman, bought her a $4,500 ring on installments. And she took off with that. And, you know, my business partners, they don't do anything. I had to do everything. And, oh, yeah, did I tell you my dad went to prison when I was 12? And, you know, as I kept talking, I started to feel a little bit better. You know, I looked at the nurses. They didn't look so good after a while. But, you know, here's what I'm going to share with you. You know, we're probably in there an hour. And this was like a magic moment in time, because this big old nurse looked at me and she said, "Well, honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do." I thought, well, sure, what the hell was I thinking? If you had people do to you what they did to me, and things happened to you like they happened to me, by God, you'd drink and you'd be depressed too. You know, I spent the next 16 days in the hospital kind of helping everybody else. You know, I thought God had sent me there on a mission, you know. I had this old depressed minister I was trying to help out. You know, I'm doing so well. Now, this is insanity. But halfway through this stay, they say to me one day, "You can have a night out." I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "Well, you can go out for a couple hours, call somebody, you know, as long as you're back by curfew." So I call my best buddy, and we go right to the watering hole. You know, go over, get 3 or 4 glasses of Scotch whiskey, dock down about 7 or 8 beers, got a big old bottle of wine, you know, just got ripped. And I remember looking at my watch, it was 10:45. I said, "Hey, I got curfew at the nut house. I got to get back." So he drives me back to Our Lady of Peace, you know, and I never forget this. I'm sliding out of the passenger side to go back in the hospital. I look over at him, and he's got tears running down his face. I said, "What's wrong with you?" He said, "You don't belong in there." "I do." And I said, "You know, I think you're right." I said, "When I get out of here, I'll help you." Man. You know, and that's 1985. I'm not going to get here to 1990. And I came out of the nut house and I did what I always did. Got a new place to live. I got a new girlfriend. I got new business partners. I was always starting over, you know. Alcoholics are the best starter overs in the world. Can't finish much, but we can flat start over, you know. Got back together with Gail in 1990, and we did the whole thing. Bought the new big house, tried to make all the external changes we could, and it just got worse. Unbeknownst to me, she started going to Al-Anon at this time. But it got worse for me. The booze and the depression, it was awful. New Year's Day of 1990, I also had a tendency to be violent when I drank. You know, probably my Irish heritage. You know, and I never got in a fight in my life sober, I don't think. But boy, I've been in a lot of them drunk. And we also got in a lot of verbal sparring when I was drinking, and sometimes it turned to pushing and shoving. And I came home that day at New Year's Day of 1990, And we got into one of those types of things, and shouting and then pushing, and she took off to get in her car to get out of there, and chased her down to the garage because I was afraid to lose her. And she took off, and I ended up breaking the mirror on the side of her car, which she left that way for a long time, by the way. You know, and she took off and went somewhere. You know, but I want to share with you that I fell down that night in that garage on that concrete floor, and I was laying there with my tears running into that oil that was under that car, you know, and I finally said, you know, God, what's the deal here? You know, what's the deal? Please help me. Please help me. You know, He was going to help me, not immediately. Obviously, I got thrown out then, and I ended up spending the next 4, 5, 6 months in a guy's basement out in the south end of Louisville, you know. And I can't tell you anything changed there, except I got isolated a little bit. It kind of became my treatment center somehow. I would get up every day and I'd go to work, get out of that basement, and April 12th of 1990, I got up like I always did, and I went into my office, and I'm in a business where the phone rings all day, people are in and out of that office all day. All I can tell you, April 12th of 1990, I went in there, sit down at 8 o'clock, never moved a muscle, and the phone didn't ring for the next 4.5 hours, and nobody ever came to that office. I guess it was my moment of clarity, what the book talks about. It was my time of clearness, because what I knew, I just knew it was over. I just knew it was over. That's the sense that I had. And I reached in my drawer and I found a directory of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, which a guy had given me 2.5 years before. And I went to my first meeting that day, and you know, the whole journey and this thing began, you know. And here's what I want to share with you, you know, and I loved what Marianne said last night. And the last 10 years I have been up and down and all around, and the only thing I've done for sure is I've stayed sober. Stayed pretty happy and had a lot of fun. But beyond that, you know, it's been a real, real roller coaster type of thing. You know, I was about 14 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was doing the best I could. Hadn't done the steps. Didn't have a real sponsor. And if you'd have run into me and say, Tim, are you having a good time? I'd say, yeah. God damn it, I'm having a great time. What do you want to know for? You know? I mean, I was about ready to kill somebody, you know? And I had a sponsor, and I would call him, and he would say every night to me, he said, Tim, just say over and over, God is love, God is love, God is love. And I couldn't even go to sleep. You know, so a lot of times, that's how I would go to sleep. God is love, God is love, God is love. You know, I'm 14 months, and I'm just coming apart this night. And I said, you know, if I call him, if he tells me that God is love stuff one more time, I'm going to go get him. You know? And sure enough, I said, you know, this is my problem of the day. And he said, Tim, just remember, God is love. And I said, God damn it, I know he is. But man, I am depressed and I am angry. He said, all right, I think you're ready. I think you're ready for the second part. He said, Tim, God is love, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, love is action. God is love, love is action. God is love, steps 1, 2, 3, your powerlessness, His power. Steps 4 through 9, your simple responsibility to clean up your deal. Step 10, a refresher course every day. Step 11, you get hooked up with God. Step 12, you're hooked up with the people. Are you ready? I said, yeah, I'm ready, man, because I cannot live like this. This is no fun. I'm not going to make it if I don't do something. And what happened in 14 months sober, he sent me down to a little meeting downtown, and I became the coffee maker at this meeting. And I got into a big book study and did the steps for the first time. I needed to mention to you that he gave me a tape of a guy named Jerry J. from Dallas. And it was the first time I heard anybody talk about the 12 steps. He told me to follow exactly how to do those steps the way Jerry did. And I listened to that tape over and over. And I did the steps exactly the way he said to do them. So it's always real special for me to see him because he's here tonight. And you know what happened to me at 14 months is I was a legitimate member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was making the coffee and I had done the steps. And I finally felt that I belonged. You know, and I'd like to tell you, you know, you have crazy stuff go through your head. You know, I thought early on in sobriety that someday in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the way I thought, I'd be this kind of sophisticated, white-haired guy. I'd wear these real nice sweaters, probably smoke a pipe. And I'd sit around the meetings of AA just looking really sober and serene, you know. Wouldn't say much. Probably twice a year I'd get up and say something really profound. So I told somebody one time I kind of saw myself as the Perry Como of Alcoholics Anonymous. Wow. I say that because it's been everything but that, you know. I mean, 2 years sober, I left my home group one Saturday morning and went home. And for no particular reason, except I don't think I was getting the type of respect that a guy 2 years sober should be getting. And went nuts. Flipped the bed over, you know, pushed the drapes down, pushed the furniture down. Just started screaming at the top of my lungs. You know what the problem was? It was 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, and I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to do Saturday without booze. And I remember my kids coming to the door looking at me like they used to look at me when I was drinking, saying, "Dad, what happened?" And what happened was they were looking at the disease of alcoholism, you know. 3 years sober, I got in a fist fight with my 19-year-old son, and he knocked my tooth out. You know, I thought, these are not Perry Como type things here, Tim. You're not on your way to spiritual gianthood here. But, you know, I'm not. You know, it took me a long time to understand that, you know, what this is all about, you know, that I am not God. There is one. You're not it. I'm a human being, and what human beings do is we mess up. We fall down. We make mistakes. We're very imperfect. And the best we'll ever be able to do is ask God to help us balance our lives between that bright, lovely side of us and that shadow side of us. You know, but I had this idea that I was going to race off into this, you know, spiritualness. And it's just not the way it is. Thank God it's not the way it is, because I don't think any of us would ever make it. You know, the other thing that he said to me one time, you know, early on was, you know, because I want to say this, because I heard a lot of people talking about this in the workshops. He said, "Tim, now don't get mad at me, but I'm going to tell you something. You don't have any skills." I said, "Screw you." You know? He said, "No, I don't mean that. You don't have any living skills." He said, "Most of us, when we come in, we have two skills. You know, fight and flee. Fight and flee." My whole life was a variation of two things. You know, I either fought you and ran, or ran and fought you. You know, fought you, ran, came back, fought you and ran. You know, that's all I knew to do. I didn't know how to stay in the deal, how to stand in the middle of a problem in a relationship, how to stand in the middle of a problem at work. You know, and I've learned from other men in Alcoholics Anonymous and retreats I've been to, you know, how to do that thing. You know, my skills, people skills, were so bad when I first got back together with Gail when I was first sober. I mean, every night we were into an argument, you know. Every night. I finally said to to my sponsor, I said, "Look, I don't know what to say to stay out of a confrontation with her." He said, "All right, let me give you some tools here. Here's the first one. If she says something, you just say to her, 'Well, how can I help? How can I help?'" So that was the first one. How can I help? I thought that was good. So, you know, how can I help? Second thing he said, you know, you'll find some people don't want your help. So you just tell them, "Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. I'm sorry you feel that way." And the third thing he says, try to validate other people, Tim, by telling them they may be right. You may be right. So here we go, boy. For about 6 weeks, I got these tools, right? How can I help? Sorry you feel that way. You may be right. I left a men's meeting one Tuesday night, and I kind of floated home, you know, as we do, you know, spiritual as I could be. Floated into the kitchen, and I sit down at the kitchen table, and all hell was breaking loose in there. You know, she was yelling at my daughter was yelling at my son. They were all, and I'm sitting there in my chair. She comes into the kitchen, and I spun around to do my thing, and she said, "Don't give me that how can you help shit." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry you feel that way." She said, "You asshole." I said, "Well, you might be right." Oh, brother. I can tell you what, I can abuse anything, you know. Let me close with a couple things. The gifts. For the last 10 years, we could talk all night. You know, I have a brother who's right next to me who came in the program a year after me, and that's just been a blessing. I've had just so many wonderful friendships with so many people. Let me share with you two things that have just happened, or one that just happened, and it relates to the Texas thing again. You know, when I was down in Texas to that man-to-man a couple years ago, when I was going through that divorce and that relationship, that AA relationship, I had to live with my daddy. You know, there was nowhere else to go. So here I was again, back with my daddy. My mom had died in 1995. And in 1995, he was still drinking pretty heavy. You know, and I had to contend with this. He threw me out of his house two different times in 1995. You know, I'd come from the hospital. He'd be over there drunk. I'd go over there to talk to him. And he would say things to me like, ah, get out of here, you big shot. You think just because you're sober, you know you're somebody. Get out of here, you son of a bitch. You know, and he would throw me out. This is 1995, you know. So we had a relationship that never really healed up. And even when I got sober, he was still drinking pretty heavy. And so we had a problem. You know, what happened was about 2 years in 1997, he had a little stroke. And the stroke was just enough that it kind of took away his desire to drink. You know, his memory got bad, a few other things, but he really was told he couldn't drink, and whatever other obsession he had was gone, you know. And, you know, I guess God gets some people sober in different ways. And for those last 2 years, you know, it was the best he'd ever been. So I got to live with him that period of time, and it was not easy, and I didn't like it. But I always tell a story, because right before I came down to Lake Brownwood, I walked into his house, where my bedroom was, and he had washed all my clothes. He had ironed them. He had folded them. He had put them in my suitcase on my bed. And he said to me, Tim, I know where you're going. And I want you to know I'm proud of you and I love you. You know. And I went down to Lake Brownwood to that conference, and it was a special thing. And I say that because my daddy died this year on February the 6th, which happened to be my mother's birthday. And I got to be right there, sitting next to him, and I had a hold of his hand and his pulse, and I got to feel it as it ticked down to the very last beat. And what I wanted to share with you, the glory and the grace to be so super clean with him because of what had happened. You know, that was such a lousy thing I was going through, but what came out of it was an incredible blessing because it healed a long-term relationship up that would have never happened had I not gone back and lived with him. So God does bank shots, as Ken says, and that was one for me. Final story I want to share with you. When I was about 4 years sober, my second son went to Catholic high school, and they had at the high school what they called a retreat. And I'm 4 years sober now, and what they do, they take 50 teenage boys, and they're black and they're white. They take the jocks and the rock and rollers, and they mix them all up, and they take them for 3 days out in the woods. And for those 3 days, those kids find out that they're not so different as they thought they were. And they share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. You know, and what they do the last day, they bring all the kids back. They put them up here on the podium. And all the parents sit out there and they listen to these kids share what happened to them over those 3 days. You know, and I remember being there and the first thing I thought was, damn, this is our thing, you know. This is what we do. You know, they stole our deal, you know. And all the kids started to share, you know, my son came up, and I don't remember exactly what he said. It doesn't matter because I know what I heard. You know, and he said, you know, I want to thank my mom. She's been through a lot, you know. She's a wonderful lady, and I love her very so much. He said, you know, but I really want to talk about my dad. He said, you know, because I've seen a man completely change his life around in the last year and a half. If I can become half the man that my daddy is today, that's all I could ever ask for. You know, my daddy is my hero. You know, and I say this because it was the first time I realized what had happened to me. Through God's grace, by nothing I had done, I was sitting there listening to a kid say things to me that I had no right to be said, only because of God's grace and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and the interesting thing about this whole deal was there were 50 kids, 49 of them had shared, and there was one little guy there, and he wasn't going to do it. And you could feel these other 49 boys moving up around this kid. And you could hear a pin drop, just like you could hear it tonight. And you could feel the power of love in this room. And these kids kept moving up around this little kid. And he finally got up to the podium. And he started out and he started to stutter. And he said, Dad, I love you. You know, and I just wanted to go to my knees, you know, because what I realized at that moment was, you know, that was me. That was me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, afraid, afflicted, and the power of love that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me one day to put my hand up and say, I'm Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. The power of love, which is right here tonight, I saw it in those 18-year-old boys. But you know what? Those 18-year-old boys left that retreat, and 2 days from there, they were 18-year-old boys again, doing everything that the 18-year-old boys do. And you know what I thought? Damn, I can be part of what I just saw every day of my life as long as I choose to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I don't, shame on me. I am so grateful to be a part of the power that's here this weekend. I'm so grateful to come and share my story. I do want to, you know, thank my special friend Jack Solomon, who did pass away this year. It's kind of a neat deal because Jack is kind of indirectly responsible for me being here. And also, it gives me a sense of the legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the Internet's not new, folks. The World Wide Web was started in 1935 by two guys named Bill and Bob. And it's worldwide, and it's bigger, and certainly more important than the Internet will ever be. God bless all of you. I love you.